Synthesis of Yoga, Chapter 4, in the introduction, the systems of yoga. This appeared in print on the 15th of November, 1914. Sri Aurobindo is beginning to warm to his subject. He's actually getting into the heart of what he wants to discuss, having set the template by describing the forces of nature as they are manifested from the Supreme Reality, basing themselves, all of these planes invested in matter, all of these planes similarly invested in life, which seems to emerge from matter, all of these planes similarly invested in the mind, which is also a universal reality. There's one reality that is stated along this column, and all of it is represented in each element. So it isn't that matter is absent mind and life, or life is absent matter and mind, or mind is absent matter and life. All are essentially present in every level, but there is the prominence, there is the dispensation that this shall be the form, this shall be the vivification, this shall be the illumination. So that forms a linked chain which insinuates, which invites the process of evolution. Each plane calling to the one below to come and join, each inserting its influence to stimulate, to awaken, so that it will come and join. All of it a long cosmic journey to reach again the point of origin. This is the whole track of evolution. But along the way, since everything is illuminated, everything rejoined to the originating reality, there is a grand harmony that is not absent possibility always, but which is not manifest always. We make manifest what is essentially true, and we do it through form. We do it through relationship. The universe is all about relationship. It's all about what occurs within the context of the cosmos. It is one being looking at itself from innumerable standpoints. There is only one being, but it is in constant relationship with itself, iterating and reiterating, discovering and announcing and rediscovering new possibilities. And along the way, there is this graded evolution. But the relationship within its own being is the meaning of the universe. Relationships, therefore, whether they're relationships of our individual vehicle, mind relating to life and body, one person relating to another, a person relating to the larger society, a person relating to the globe, a person relating to the cosmos, each aspect of relationship is pregnant with meaning. The greater our consciousness, the greater our power to approach, the more justice we can bring to releasing the hidden divinity in all of these potentialities. So we never do anything for ourselves alone. We're always a part of a context, part of a larger harmony to which we are invited. We have to make it real. Sri Aurobindo begins. These relations, between the different psychological divisions of the human being and these various utilities and objects of effort founded on them, such as we have seen them in our brief survey of the natural evolution, we shall find repeated in the fundamental principles and methods of the different schools of yoga. And if we seek to combine and harmonize their central practices and their predominant aims, we shall find that the basis provided by nature is still our natural basis and the condition of their synthesis. In one respect, yoga exceeds the normal operation of cosmic nature and climbs beyond her. For the aim of the Universal Mother is to embrace the divine in her own play and creations, and there to realize it. But in the highest flights of yoga, she reaches beyond herself and realizes the divine in itself, exceeding the universe and even standing apart from the cosmic play. Therefore, by some, it is supposed that this is not only the highest, but also the one true or exclusively preferable object of yoga. So it is possible to move from an individual consciousness into communion with the cosmic, to develop a cosmic consciousness, but to transcend that and climb into the transcendent itself. Yet it is always through something which she has formed in her evolution that nature thus overpasses her evolution. It is the individual heart that, by sublimating its highest and purest emotions, attains to the transcendent bliss or the ineffable nirvana. The individual mind that, by converting its ordinary functionings into a knowledge beyond mentality, knows its oneness with the ineffable and merges its separate existence in that transcendent unity. And always, it is the individual, the self, conditioned in its experience by nature and working through her formations, that attains to the self unconditioned, free, and transcendent. So nature develops a ground of being, an extension of being, and then shapes an instrument through which she steps beyond to the next level. It seems that the individual might be the beginning of the conscious effort, but that in attaining to a great realization, the individual is abolished. But Sri Aurobindo will come to that point. He says that we discover oneness. He doesn't say that we are extinguished in being. Even when we achieve nirvana, we shall see that in the striking off of the ego and living, existing in the impersonal, does not abrogate the truth of the individual. The individual in its essence continues. It is not the individual that is the problem confounding nature, but the ego. The ineffable, by the way, from the Latin, ineffabilis, can't be spoken. You can have the experience of that oneness, but when you begin to speak about it, it all falls short. As the Taittiriya Upanishad said, the words fall back, unattaining. The self-conditioned, the conditioning is to take an abstract essence of being and to determine, to define, to draw limits, and therefore to create circumstances. But that is a picture in nature of the ego as it develops, and it is always the self that is developing through the ego its own instrument for launching into the beyond. Nevertheless, when it does launch, it leaves behind all these limits and restrictions and determinations and lives without condition, freely, in what is transcendent. So that is the ultimate release. Is it, therefore, and he'll come to it, the goal that we should simply get rid of our personal determinations and of all cosmic definitions? He'll answer it by and by. In practice, three conceptions are necessary before there can be any possibility of yoga. There must be, as it were, three consenting parties to the effort: God, nature, and the human soul. Or in more abstract language, the transcendental, the universal, and the individual. If the individual and nature are left to themselves, the one is bound to the other, unable to exceed appreciably her lingering march. Something transcendent is needed, free from her and greater, which will act upon us and her, attracting us upward to itself, and securing from her, by good grace or by force, her consent to the individual ascension. So something must invite us to a greater level of being, by which we can return upon nature and coax her forward. It is this truth which makes necessary to every philosophy of yoga the conception of the Ishvara, Lord, Supreme Soul or Supreme Self, towards whom the effort is directed and who gives the illuminating touch and the strength to attain. Strictly speaking, it's true, in yoga philosophies, there is this theistic orientation that there is a conscious master of existence who draws you upwards, who gives you the grace, who liberates you. Even in the Yoga Sutra, although it's unclear there as to what stance the Ishvara has really in terms of empowering others to realize, still there is the term. Equally true is the complementary idea so often enforced by the yoga of devotion that as the transcendent is necessary to the individual and sought after by him, so also the individual is necessary in a sense to the transcendent and sought after by it. We're looking for the divine, but the divine is looking for us. I remember M.P. Pundit decades ago saying that the gods, even the gods, let alone the transcendent Ishvara, even the gods are always looking to see when someone in humanity is ready for their touch. They watch, they look at the expressions, they look at the gestures, they see if the mudra is beginning to come automatically to the person, and then they lean in to that symbol and give it force, give it light, give it energy. So always there are benevolent presences waiting to assist, waiting for us to seek their assistance. If the bhakta seeks and yearns after Bhagavan, Bhagavan also seeks and yearns after the bhakta. The relationship between the divine and the devotee is deep, and communicant, Bhakta, the devotee or lover of God. Bhagavan, God, the Lord of love and delight. The third term of the Trinity is Bhagavan, the divine revelation of love. Bhaga means what is felicitous, what is full, what is happy, what is blessed, therefore. There can be no yoga of knowledge without a human seeker of the knowledge. The supreme subject of knowledge and the divine use by the individual of the universal faculties of knowledge. No yoga of devotion without the human God-lover, the supreme object of love and delight, and the divine use by the individual of the universal faculties of spiritual, emotional, and aesthetic enjoyment. No yoga of works without the human worker, the supreme will, master of all works and sacrifices, and the divine use by the individual of the universal faculties of power and action. However monistic may be our intellectual conception of the highest truth of things, in practice, we are compelled to accept this omnipresent Trinity, three in one, triune, the transcendent, the cosmic, the individual. For the contact of the human and individual consciousness with the divine is the very essence of yoga. Yoga is the union of that which has become separated in the play of the universe with its own true self, origin, and universality. True self, individual. Origin, the transcendent. Universality, the cosmic context. The contact may take place at any point of the complex and intricately organized consciousness which we call our personality. It may be affected in the physical through the body, in the vital through the action of those functionings which determine the state and the experiences of our nervous being, through the mentality, whether by means of the emotional heart, the active will, or the understanding mind, or more largely by a general conversion of the mental consciousness in all its activities. It may equally be accomplished through a direct awakening to the universal or transcendent truth and bliss by the conversion of the central ego in the mind. And according to the point of contact that we choose will be the type of the yoga that we practice. Now later Sri Aurobindo shifts the language that he uses. His vocabulary is a little different than it is here in 1914 as he's just beginning to write publicly about yoga. The direct awakening, sahaja, the spontaneous sight. But these other types of contact are deliberative. They are part of a goal. They are part of a process that take you to that awakening, to that contact. Without the contact, you can't have the communion. You can't have the further union. So the contact will be in that part of your being which is made most ready, which is the most evolved. It's wonderful if all the being can become aflame with that contact, or that it proceed rapidly from one part of the being to another. But somewhere, something in you has to become alive to the touch of the divine, that contact. For if, leaving aside the complexities of their particular processes, we fix our regard on the central principle of the chief schools of yoga still prevalent in India, we find that they arrange themselves in an ascending order, which starts from the lowest rung of the ladder, the body, and ascends to the direct contact between the individual soul and the transcendent and universal self. Hatha Yoga selects the body and the vital functionings as its instruments of perfection and realization. Its concern is with the gross body. Hatha Yoga. Hatha means forceful. Yoga means union, or the process that takes you to union. Yoga means restraint, control, regulation. So it's the system, it's the forceful system that takes you to union with the divine, as Sri Aurobindo says, at the point of the gross body, to bring the divine realization into the consciousness, the cellular awareness of the body. Raja Yoga selects the mental being and its different parts as its lever power. It concentrates on the subtle body. Raja, meaning in this case royal. So this is the great, this is the kingly yoga. This is the best of all yogas, to awaken and subtleize and merge the mind into the great reality with a capital R. It does it through the inner instrument. Where Hatha Yoga works in the gross body, Raja Yoga uses the subtle body, the Sukshma Sharira, as the means of ascent. The triple path of works, of love, and of knowledge uses some part of the mental being, will, heart, or intellect, as a starting point, and seeks by its conversion to arrive at the liberating truth, beatitude, and infinity, which are the nature of the spiritual life. Its method is a direct commerce between the human Purusha in the individual body and the divine Purusha who dwells in every body and yet transcends all form and name. So this would be from the perspective of the Bhagavad Gita. This is the triple path, the Trimarga. Awakening oneness in the mind through knowledge, in the heart through love, and in works through action. Always the one is attained. You begin where you're most ready. And then you use that as a base, and you bring the others in with it so that they support and harmonize your effort and fulfill and complete. And note in this last, the human Purusha in the individual body is merged into the divine Purusha who is in every body, a universal reality, and yet transcends all form and name, is that absolute origin beyond. That absolute origin beyond gives birth to cosmos and gives birth to individual. In both move in alignment back towards that origin. Hatha Yoga aims at the conquest of the life and the body, whose combination in the food sheath and the vital vehicle constitutes, as we have seen, the gross body, and whose equilibrium is the foundation of all nature's workings in the human being, Anamaya Kosha. The equilibrium established by nature is sufficient for the normal egoistic life. It is insufficient for the purpose of the Hatha Yogin, for it is calculated on the amount of vital or dynamic force necessary to drive the physical engine during the normal span of human life and to perform more or less adequately the various workings demanded of it by the individual life inhabiting this frame and the world environment by which it is conditioned. Hatha Yoga, therefore, seeks to rectify nature and establish another equilibrium by which the physical frame will be able to sustain the inrush of an increasing vital or dynamic force of prana, indefinite, almost infinite in its quantity or intensity. In nature, the equilibrium is based upon the individualization of a limited quantity and force of the prana. More than that, the individual is by personal and hereditary habit unable to bear, use, or control. In Hatha Yoga, the equilibrium opens a door to the universalization of the individual vitality by admitting into the body, containing, using, and controlling a much less fixed and limited action of the universal energy. So Hatha Yoga is going to make nature right by making the body plastic, strengthening it, opening it, making it wide so that it becomes commensurate in a sense with the universe around. Therefore, something oceanic from the plane of prana can move into and through it. Without that stabilizing effort, without that strengthening effort, without that effort to make the body plastic, it could not hold that oceanic life. So its whole demand upon the being is that it be made like a warrior, be made adamantine. The chief processes of Hatha Yoga are asana and pranayama. Asana is a word that means seat. Pranayama means life regulation. It is the regulation of the power of existence. People translate it as breath control. Prana is far more than simply breath. By its numerous asanas or fixed postures, it first cures the body of that restlessness which is a sign of its inability to contain without working them off in action and movement the vital forces poured into it from the universal life ocean, gives to it an extraordinary health, force, and suppleness, and seeks to liberate it from the habits by which it is subjected to ordinary physical nature and kept within the narrow bounds of her normal operations. So we establish in the body ekagrata, one-seatedness, the one not moving. The body must become still. That's why it's called a seat. You stabilize the body. In the ancient tradition of Hatha Yoga, it has always been supposed that this conquest could be pushed so far even as to conquer to a great extent the force of gravitation. Well, a couple of things to mention here. The ancient tradition of Hatha Yoga. Hatha Yoga probably begins really in the 9th century CE. No doubt there must have been something prior to that, but the origination of the system of Hatha Yoga, which begins with Goraksha, can be dated to that point. You can see here that this is the sort of the popular view of Hatha Yoga, that the person takes up the practice in order to gain victories of various kinds, which are called siddhis in their parlance, including levitation. By various subsidiary but elaborate processes, the Hatha Yogin next contrives to keep the body free from all impurities and the nervous system unclogged for those exercises of respiration which are his most important instruments. So we get the body stabilized, and then we turn to something more important than that. The asanas are important, but they are not the most important aspect of the Hatha Yogic practice. Pranayama for the Hatha Yogin serves a double purpose. First, It completes the perfection of the body. The vitality is liberated from many of the ordinary necessities of physical nature. Robust health, prolonged youth, often an extraordinary longevity are attained. On the other hand, pranayama awakens the coiled-up serpent of the pranic dynamism in the vital sheath and opens to the yogin fields of consciousness, ranges of experience, abnormal faculties denied to the ordinary human life, while it puissantly intensifies such normal powers and faculties as he already possesses. So what you've already developed gets better, and you're introduced into ranges of action that were previously closed off to you. This is the awakening of the Kundalini, famously. Sri Aurobindo, you may know, practiced pranayama himself even before he had some of the great realizations that characterized his early life, and did it for several hours every day. So he was no stranger to the practice of pranayama. These advantages can be farther secured and emphasized by other subsidiary processes open to the Hatha Yoga. The results of Hatha Yoga are thus striking to the eye and impose easily on the vulgar or physical mind. And yet at the end, we may ask what we have gained at the end of all this stupendous labor. The object of physical nature, the preservation of the mere physical life, its highest perfection, even in a certain sense, the capacity of a greater enjoyment of physical living, have been carried out on an abnormal scale. But the weakness of Hatha Yoga is that its laborious and difficult processes make so great a demand on the time and energy, and impose so complete a severance from the ordinary life of men, that the utilization of its results for the life of the world becomes either impracticable or is extraordinarily restricted. If in return for this loss we gain another life in another world within, the mental, the dynamic, these results could have been acquired through other systems, through Raja Yoga, through Tantra, by much less laborious methods and held on much less exacting terms. On the other hand, the physical results, increased vitality, prolonged youth, health, longevity, are of small avail if they must be held by us as misers of ourselves, apart from the common life, for their own sake, not utilized, not thrown into the common sum of the world's activities. Hatha Yoga attains large results, but at an exorbitant price and to very little purpose. We're going to pause here because I think Hatha Yoga has become synonymous with the practice of yoga in the West. And so to understand it to its roots, I think, is necessary. So next week, I propose that rather than going forward right away with this chapter, that we stop to talk about the origin of Hatha Yoga and some of the aims that it had and the context in which it developed. So we'll get to Raja Yoga soon. I hope you're not in a hurry. If not, good. I'm not either. Tonight, from Savitri, this is a section from Book 2, The Book of the Traveler of the Worlds. Canto 5, The Godheads of the Little Life. Each part in us desires its absolute. Our thoughts covet the everlasting light. Our strength derives from an omnipotent force. And since from a veiled God joy the worlds were made, and since eternal beauty asks for form, even here, where all is made of being's dust, our hearts are captured by ensnaring shapes. Our very senses blindly seek for bliss. Our error crucifies reality to force its birth and divine body here, compelling, incarnate in a human form, and breathing in limbs that one can touch and clasp, its knowledge to rescue an ancient ignorance, its savior light, the inconscient universe. And when that greater self comes sea light down to fill this image of our transience, all shall be captured by delight, transformed. In waves of undreamed ecstasy shall roll our mind and life and sense, and laugh in a light other than this hard, limited human day. The body's tissues thrill apotheosized. Its cells sustain bright metamorphosis. This little being of time, this shadow soul, this living dwarf figurehead of darkened spirit, out of its traffic in petty dreams shall rise. Its shape of person and its ego face, divested of this mortal travesty, like a clay troll kneaded into a god, new made in the image of the eternal guest, it shall be caught to the breast of a white force, and flaming with a paradisal touch, in a rose fire of sweet spiritual grace, in the red passion of its infinite change, quiver, awake, and shudder with ecstasy. As if reversing a deformation spell, released from the black magic of the night, renouncing servitude to the dim abyss, it shall learn at last who lived within unseen, and seized with marvel in the adoring heart, to the enthroned child godhead kneel aware, trembling with beauty and delight and love. But first the spirit's ascent we must achieve, out of the chasm from which our nature rose. The soul must soar sovereign above the form and climb to summits beyond mind's half-sleep. Our hearts we must inform with heavenly strength, surprise the animal with the occult god. Then, kindling the gold tongue of sacrifice, calling the powers of a bright hemisphere, we shall shed the discredit of our mortal state, make the abysm a road for heaven's descent, acquaint our depths with the supernal ray, and cleave the darkness with the mystic fire. Namaste, Jai Ma.